Foundation Executive Director.
We're
sorry we don't have a microphone. It unfortunately wasn't here. It was supposed to be here, so we're sorry about that. So if you can just talk, I guess, a bit louder. I'm sure you're used to it. So without further ado, it's Rodney Cohen.
Yeah, I do this all the time. My voice will start to go about three quarters of the way through, but I'm happy to simply project. What I'm going to be talking about tonight, some of you might have already heard of. You might have heard about free software, maybe under the moniker open source. And you might have heard about how it's more reliable, more stable, has fewer bugs. And all those sorts of things are precisely not what I'm going to be talking about tonight. While I think making software more reliable and more stable and more dependable is a worthy goal and should be done, I think that these concerns are ultimately secondary to other issues that don't relate directly at all to software quality. In fact, I think the issues of technology are ultimately secondary to augmenting community and fostering goodwill and cooperation among users and programmers of computer software. What I hope to demonstrate to you over the next hour and a half, through personal anecdotes, through some ethical consideration, and through some historical perspective, is how free software serves to create these kinds of cooperating communities that foster goodwill, and how, by direct contrast, the opposite of free software, proprietary software, impedes and tears down these types of communities. So the first thing that I unfortunately have to do in a talk like this is to define the term free software. They always tell you not to start a talk by defining the terms you're going to use. But I'm forced to do this, unfortunately, because English has a bug in it. We have more words than any other language on the planet, but we have only one adjective for two very different ideas. We use the word free to refer to free as in freedom and free as in price. When we're talking about free software, we're talking about freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. I know that's particularly hard for college students, but I hope you'll try anyway. The reason that we're talking primarily about freedom is because paying is not the central issue. Some people get free software without paying for it. Other people do pay for free software. But the important thing is that you get freedom when you get that free software. There are basically four freedoms that you, a particular user, gets with free software. And this is always defined in terms of a particular user. This is because a particular free software program might be free software for one user, but that same exact program is not free software for another user. So the first freedom that you get with free software is the freedom to run the program for any purpose. You have the freedom to run the program even in a way that the programmer of that software or the distributor of that software never imagined. So if you find some novel way to use the software that you have the freedom to use it in that way. The second freedom that you get is the freedom to help yourself by changing the software or modifying it to suit your needs. Now, this freedom can be taken direct benefit of by programmers. They know how to change and modify software. But there is an indirect benefit to this freedom for non-programmers. Non-programmers are permitted with free software to hire anyone they want to work on their free software, or are permitted to find someone to contribute altruistically without charging them changes and improvements to their free software. So this works, as I said, both in a commercial and a non-commercial sense. Some people might pay to get modifications to free software. Other people might not pay. But the important thing is that everyone has the freedom to modify the software or ask someone else to do it for them. The third freedom that you get is the freedom to help other people by sharing your software. And again, this happens in a commercial and in a non-commercial environment. You can give someone a CD containing free software just because you like them or because they saw you running free software on your computer and wanted to try it out. So you have that altruistic aspect of sharing free software. But there's also the commercial sharing of free software. You can go into business selling copies of free software. In fact, there are companies like Red Hat that consistently are able to sell free software for 35 times the price that you can get it somewhere else because people just happen to be willing to pay it. Now, it is the case that it's rarely incredibly expensive to get a copy of a particular free software program. And this is simply because of the free market. Since anyone is allowed to sell it for any price that they name, it turns out that prices stay reasonably low. They're all seem to be within 35 times of each other. You can get a copy of Red Hat's free software for $1 from some places, and if you buy from them, you pay about $35. But the fact that it's kept low priced has nothing to do with the freedoms that you get in a direct sense, only in an indirect sense, that as people exercise these freedoms in a free market, it tends to set the prices at a reasonable price. The final freedom that you get is the freedom to help the community by sharing the changes you've made or you have commissioned to be made to free software. So once you've paid for these modifications or done them yourself because you were interested in it, you have the freedom to share those changes with others. And you can do this, again, as an altruistic act. Lots of people, in fact, most of the people who improve free software do so out of the love for the thing because they enjoy it. And they post these changes to mailing lists or to websites and share them with other people. There's also lots of companies who are in the business of contracting themselves out to improve and modify free software. And they do this in a commercial sense. You have to pay them to get them to make the changes you want. But they have the freedom to do that because it's free software. By contrast, proprietary software can be defined simply as the opposite of free software. It is software that severely restricts, impedes, or takes away most or all of the freedoms I've been talking about. It turns out that it used to be the case that you had the freedom to run programs for any purpose if they were proprietary. You could run them in any way you saw fit once you got a copy of the program, but even that freedom doesn't exist anymore. Recent versions of Microsoft's front page software for website development have in the license terms that say you are not permitted to use that software to create websites that say bad things about Microsoft. So even your freedom to run the program is restricted with that kind of software. Of course, your freedom to change and modify the program is restricted, not only by the terms of the license, which of course forbids you to do so, but also by the simple fact that you're distributed only the binary code of the software. Humans don't modify the binary code of the program. They use something called source code. That's the thing that humans understand. They put it through an automated process called a compiler, and they get this binary code out on the other end. Microsoft doesn't give you the human-readable source code. They give you only the binaries. All other proprietary software companies do the same thing. So you don't have the freedom to modify it because modifying binary code is nearly impossible. It takes months to make a change that would take just minutes with the source code. Of course, your freedom to share the software is directly restricted. The licenses say you can't make copies of it, and many times it has technology inside that hidden binary that make it difficult for you to make copies. So your freedom to share and to share any modifications that you might be able to make are restricted in that way. There's a full spectrum of software in between, software that gives you some of these freedoms but not others. But that turns out to be quite rare. Usually software is either free software or it is proprietary software. Those are the two different things I'm going to be speaking about tonight. Now, I'm happy to take questions about this other gray area, and I'll hold all the questions about stuff till the end if you have questions about what we would call semi-free software, software that's in this in-between state. But what I want to focus on is free software and proprietary software. From my point of view, the burden is on me to prove to you that these freedoms matter. In our society, we give up lots of different freedoms because we've agreed as a culture that they just aren't important. For example, someone might get up here and speak about having the freedom to drive your car in any direction you want, at any time you want, at any speed you want. They might make arguments about how this is better for society. But we as a culture have decided that those freedoms just aren't important enough. We've created speed limits and stoplights and stop signs because we believe it's better to allow everyone to have access to the roads and not kill each other by driving all over the place in all different directions. So the case would have to be made that this freedom was somehow fundamental. In fact, someone would have to make the case that some harm is caused by not having that freedom. In that particular case, it turns out harm is caused if people are given that freedom. So we decided as a society that it's not necessary. But it's my burden to show you that there is real harm caused by proprietary software. I, in fact, myself was skeptical about this issue. I am part of what I call the GNU Age, a group of computer scientists who came of age after free software was basically readily available for use and for improvement. And I grew up in a world where you could get some free software. There was still a lot of proprietary software, but if you wanted free software, it was out there for the taking. So because I lived in that world, I was skeptical that there was any harm caused by having that other stuff, by having proprietary software. It, in fact, took me about 14 years to come to a realization that proprietary software was harmful. I'm hoping to convince you tonight in just an hour and a half, so maybe not all of you will be convinced, but hopefully you're less dense than I am and will get it a little bit quicker than I did. My whole experience of that 14 years starts when my relationship with software started. My first computer was a Commodore 64. It was, there's always somebody in the crowd who cheers for that. It's very strange. It was this computer that you got. It didn't come with any real software on it. It had BASIC burned into the ROM chip of the computer itself. If you wanted any software, you could either get it on cassette tape, which was really bad, or you could get the 1541 Commodore 64 diskette drive, which was a 5 1/4 diskette drive. It was about that long and about that high, and it would probably weigh more than this laptop sitting next to me does today. But in some sense, this was a portable unit, right? You could pick it up and sort of lug it around and that sort of thing. So it was somewhat of a portable system for that definition of portable in those days. So what I discovered was I didn't have that much software. I had a bunch of blank 5 1/4 diskettes and a computer with BASIC on it. So I wanted to get more software. So I joined a Commodore 64 computer club that met in my neighborhood. I went every month, and eventually I met some other kids my age who had Commodore 64 computers as well, and we started to play together, to use our computers together. Now, from our point of view, at 10 years old, we didn't treat the computer any differently than any other toy we were used to playing with. And our parents had designed some rules that we were supposed to follow when we got a toy, and they came up because of real practical concerns. The first rule was generally to share, to make sure that everybody got a turn with a particular toy. You weren't supposed to hoard your toys and not let other people try them out or play with them. Everybody was supposed to have a turn with any particular toy. So that was one rule that we were supposed to follow. The second rule was a little bit stranger, and it had to do with a specific situation. We had this rule that we should try to find in games that would include everybody's toys. Now, this came up because Star Wars was very popular when I was this age. And there was the official Galoob rubber-stamped-on-the-butt Star Wars figures that you could get. And there was also a variety of knockoffs, sort of generic action figures that looked like they were from space in some way. And some kids, because they were cheaper, had these knockoff type of action figures. And there was a lot of sort of battles in our little community there, because the kids who had the official Star Wars toys wouldn't play with the kids who had the unofficial action figures. So our parents had made this rule that you had to invent games that included everybody's toys. Don't make it so, well, you have to have the official Millennium Falcon or you can't play with us. We weren't allowed to make rules in our games like that. We had this meta rule that we had to follow. So as we started playing with our Commodore 64 computers, we followed these rules. We quickly discovered that if you carried these semi-portable 5041 floppy drives over to another person's house who had the same floppy drive, you could plug one into the other and then run a cable to the computer. If you did this, you could make copies of the floppy disks that you had. We discovered that any game we had, immediately we could make copies of. And everybody ended up with a copy. So from our point of view, and indeed even from our parents' point of view, we had invented a game that followed the rules exactly. We found something that included everyone's toys, namely hooking all of our drives up together. You couldn't do it with just one. Making copies of disks, and we discovered that everybody got a turn because everybody got a copy of the software. We could play the games together or we could take them home and play them by ourselves. This worked out very well for a number of months until I discovered that not all the adults in the world were thinking like my parents were. I discovered this when I went to one of these Commodore 64 computer club meetings. One of the adults there named Evelyn was giving a presentation of a game that she had just gotten. This game was called Little Computer People, and it was based on the idea that a little person lived inside your computer. You had to take care of them. You had to make sure they got their three meals every day and that they got their newspaper so that they could see what was going on in their little computer person world. You even had to feed their dog as well. My favorite part about the game was that if you didn't boot it up for a while or play it for a while, that it looked at the system clock and told you, gee, you know, it's been 3 weeks since you've come to see me. I'm starving and my dog is too. So I just had to get a copy of this game. I ran up to Evelyn right after the meeting and said, please, could you give me a copy of this video game? I really want to play it. Her eyes darted a little bit. My first thought was that she just didn't have time that particular day to make a copy of the game for me. So I explained to her that my parents would happily drive me over to her house the next day. I'd bring my 1541 drive and we'd have a copy of the game in just a few minutes, and it wouldn't annoy her or take too much of her time. This didn't seem to satisfy her either. And I started to explain that this was very simple to do, and why couldn't she just do it? She finally looked at me and said, it's illegal for me to give you a copy of this game. I was taken aback. I explained that my friends and I did this all the time, that it was really simple and it couldn't possibly be illegal. After all, our parents had said it was playing together nicely, not something that was illegal. She told me that my friends and I were criminals. In fact, she had a specific word for the types of criminals we were. She said that we were pirates. Now, in my mind, I had a clear image of what a pirate was. As she told me this, my mind flashed to an imaginary Scooby-Doo episode where the villain of the week was software pirates. I imagined being at the end of the episode wearing my requisite eye patch, having Fred, the ascot-wearing alpha male of the Mystery Machine, rip off my eye patch and say, look, it was him all along making copies of software. And I imagined myself saying, and I would have gotten away with it too, if it wasn't for you darn kids. This image of the activity my friends and I were engaged in didn't fit with what I knew to be reality. We weren't criminals. We weren't hurting people. We were making the world better by sharing. Of course, I couldn't articulate that at 10 years old. So I did what any self-respecting 10-year-old would do. I told Evelyn she was really mean, and I stormed out of the meeting. In fact, I didn't even think about the event again until a good 8 years later or so. I got my first job doing computer programming professionally. I'd gotten a job working at a blood typing laboratory that designed software to check genetic blood type results and store them in a database. I was really excited, too, because for the first time I got to use a real computer. It was an AT&T 3B2600 running Unix System 5 release 2.3.2, and I still remember all of those numbers to this day. I was so excited to be using a Unix computer for the first time that I even enjoyed learning the VI text editor. I was just so excited. And a couple months later, I discovered Emacs, and then things were much better. But at the time, I was just so excited, I couldn't believe it. I had a Unix account. And we had built all this software to run on a particular database. It was the Informix database products that we used. All our software relied on it because everything made calls back to the database. So we would write the software and call to the database to do all the important work. Now, after a while, I started to discover bugs in my programs, like any programmer would. And one time, I spent a number of weeks just tracking down this one single bug. I was a young, naive programmer, and but I knew one rule, that if you had a bug, you should get the software down to a few lines that could exhibit that bug, you know, sort of a test case that would exemplify the bug, and then you could audit that code line by line and see where the bug was. So I did that. I had about 20 or 30 lines of code that would just immediately exhibit the bug, nothing else there, and I audited it, and I couldn't find what the bug was. So I took it to one of the senior programmers where I was working named Greg and said, Greg, could you look over this code? I've had this bug for a few weeks now and I just can't find it. I guess I'm just missing something. And he too audited my code line by line, checking it. And after about 20 minutes, he said, there's no bug in here at all. In fact, I think it's a bug in the underlying Informix libraries that talk to the database. And I said, no, that can't be the case. See, I was naive enough to think that if you got software in a box with shrink wrap on it from a company, that it couldn't have bugs in it. So I argued with Greg for a while, and he said, no. I've been using Informix for a number of years, and they have tons and tons of bugs in their software. But we have a tech support number that we can call. It's an 800 number. You call up, and you can file a bug report, and they'll get back to you and tell you how to fix it or to work around it. So I called in and I dutifully described this bug to the fellow on the other end of the phone at Informix Software. I even emailed him that 30 lines of source code that it would exhibit the bug so he could run it himself and see. The next day I got a call back and he said, yeah, this is a bug. And no, I don't know when there's going to be a fix for the 3B2 system. Can I close out the bug report, please? I said, well, wait a second. I've lost a couple of weeks here on this bug. And what do you mean there's no fix for the 3B2 Unix system? Are there fixes for other platforms that you run on? He said, oh, yeah, it looks like this bug has been fixed on Sun systems for a long time, but the bug fix is really Sun-specific, and it won't work on the 3B2. Now, this was a very surreal moment because we had to become experts on this 3B2 environment. It had some strange quirks to it that weren't common among other Unix-like systems. If I was looking at the source code he was looking at, I probably could have figured out what would make it work on the 3B2 and fix the bug for that system. And if I couldn't figure out, Greg probably could have. He'd been working with it for a lot longer than I had. But I couldn't get the source code. In fact, I didn't even want to ask this guy for it, even though he was sitting on the other end of the phone looking at it, because I'd learned 8 years earlier what happens when you ask someone for software who doesn't want to share it with you. And I knew a little bit more than that by that point as well. I knew that this fellow on the end of the phone had likely signed a non-disclosure agreement with Informix. This, too, was quite surreal. He got a job called Tech Support for Programmers. And then he had to sign an agreement to promise not to help any programmers. Because the most natural way that two software developers, two programmers help each other is to share the source code, to share software, to email back and forth and say, here's where my problem is, do you have it on your end? And then work out the solution. But this guy just had to sit on the other end of the phone and say, yes, it's a bug. No, I don't know when it'll be fixed. Could I please close out the bug report? This had to be a demoralizing experience for him. It certainly was for us. We would lose weeks at a time because of some Informix bug or another and get the same sort of answers. Sometimes they would give us a workaround. Sometimes maybe there was a patch. But most of the time, we just had to figure out for ourselves. We were left helpless because of the bugs in this other software. My employer wouldn't have minded if I was fixing Informix's bugs for them. They wanted their software to work, to do the blood test results right, and to store them in the database correctly. They didn't care whose software we had to fix to make that happen. They just wanted the software to work right. But we couldn't do that. We had to report back to them and tell them, we can't fix it because we don't have the source code. And it turned out that this wasn't an isolated experience. The rest of my career turned out much the same as I worked in the various different types of proprietary software jobs. After a while, I just became apathetic about the whole idea of software development. So I'd heard about this other thing you could do if you had computer science experience that was a much easier job, and you just sat around all day and told people to go away, and you didn't have to do any work at all. It was called system administration. Now, once I took one of these jobs, I realized that all these misconceptions were, in fact, misconceptions. But at the time, I thought, well, this is an easy way to have a career in computer science, and I don't have to do software development. But quite quickly, I discovered the same sorts of problems in that area of computer science. My first system administration job professionally was working for Westinghouse. I supported their mobile wireless telephone division. They built satellite telephones. They were primarily used for things like forestry services and disaster recovery, other places where a cellular system would be down or not exist. So they were pretty specific high-end products. The development environment for this mobile telephone system was built on a Solaris installation running version 2.4 of Solaris, which was old at the time. However, they'd done a full ISO 9000 certification and regression test on their software to make sure that their build environment worked properly. So upgrading was not something we could do easily. We'd have to go through regression testing again on the build environment. So we had to stick with the older versions and just install security updates and any sort of critical patch, nothing for as far as new software and that sort of thing. So I started working there, and one of the first problems they had for me to solve that had been a real pain for them for a while, one of the reasons they even hired a sysadmin, was that every morning it turned out that some people would sit down at their workstations and could log in fine, and other people would sit down at their workstations, but they couldn't log in. They'd type in their username and their password correctly, but it would tell them log in incorrect and wouldn't let them get into the system. So they asked me to track this down. I discovered that there was some strange thing that if you logged in had logged in the last 12 hours, that you could sit down at your own terminal and log in just fine. So people who had logged in remotely to their own desktop system overnight via the modem dial-up pool or some other way were just fine. So what people would do is they would go to somebody else's terminal, remotely log into their own machine, and then go back to their own terminal and be able to log in just fine. This is just the strange interaction of the bug. So what would happen is the half of the people that couldn't log in the morning would all wander to each other's to the other people's cubicles and find somebody who had an active window open, log into their own computer, then go back to their own desk. Now this wasted about a half an hour or 45 minutes every morning because people would wander into each other's cubicles and talk for a while and so forth. So I had to solve this problem so we didn't waste so much time trying to get logged in the morning. The bug turned out to be in the NIS Plus system, a proprietary software authentication system produced by Sun. And it was an interaction bug between that software and something called XDM, the X Display Manager. The two didn't work together properly. XDM was what asked you for your password. NIS Plus was what checked it against the database. And they didn't talk together right. So I looked on Sun's website for a bug fix for Solaris 2.4, and I discovered that they had indeed fixed a number of other bugs, very similar, related to NIS Plus, but hadn't fixed this one. So I called into Sun Tech support again, and like I always had to do at any of these jobs when I found a bug in proprietary software, call up tech support, And they said, yep, yeah, we know about that bug, and it's not fixed for Solaris 2.4, and we don't know when there'll be a patch. Of course, I was used to dealing with this, so I got a little aggressive and said, well, you fixed all these other bugs related to this. Why not fix this one? They said, well, NASA asked for those other bug fixes, and they're running Solaris 2.4 as well, and they're big enough to demand us to fix these kinds of bugs, but you're just not a big enough company to demand for us to fix a bug like that. You're just a small company. I was surprised to learn that Westinghouse is a small company, but in fact, apparently it was, even though we had a division of 180 people right there at the one site of many. So I had to go back to the users and deliver that same message that I hated getting myself. Yes, this is a bug. No, I don't know when it'll be fixed. Let's just hope that somebody logged in overnight each day so that somebody has an active window so we can go to that person's desk and log in. This will have to be the permanent solution. Now, this isn't to say that free software is without bugs. We have our share in free software. Some will argue we have more than our share in free software. This is not even to say that the original developer or distributor of a particular free software program will care about your bug. They might be like Sun and say, no, you're too small, I don't care about your bug. But the difference and how the situation would have been different if the software were free software would be that you had the means to fix the problem yourself, that you had the freedom to fix it or to hire anyone you want to fix it. If we weren't happy with the support we were getting from Sun and it had been free software, we could have hired someone else to support it. I could have done it myself, probably. I knew enough about programming to do it, I think. But if I didn't, I could have gotten my manager to hire somebody else instead of paying Sun for their support to tell us those kind of things. And I began to think about these issues by this point, but I had lived in this proprietary software realm, at least in the professional space, so long that and been told so many times that it was ethically wrong to think differently. That if you thought differently, you were a software pirate, you were a criminal, you were doing something illegal. That it was very difficult for me personally to wrap my brain around this. What I finally discovered was that there was a whole other world where things weren't like this. And this is because in 1992, I became an early adopter of the GNU Plus Linux system, which you may have heard under the name, shortened name, just Linux. I didn't understand any of these issues about ethics or freedom or rights of users. I just wanted a cheap Unix-like operating system to run on my PC to do my computer science homework. By the time I was a sophomore, I was using it quite regularly. This was around 1992, beginning of 93. And I told some of the faculty at the computer science department where I went to college about this new operating system, or GNU, better put, GNU operating system, which wasn't, in fact, new at the time. And I said, this works really good. We could use it here. And they said, that's a really good idea. In fact, we're about to buy a bunch of commodity PC hardware to replace the Windows lab that we were currently using and install a Unix-like system. And this really solves the problem for us because we can run it on the commodity hardware and it's free software. So I actually got hired that summer to work installing GNU Plus Linux systems around the lab. So even back in 1992, I was making a profit working on free software. I was a free software business person, in a sense. I was getting a stipend from the school to do work installing, configuring, and rolling out free software. Of course, I discovered a bug pretty quickly. In those days, in GNU Plus Linux systems, if you hit Control-Alt-Delete, the system just automatically rebooted. There was no way to control it at all. It just automatically did that. If you put these three keys down and hit it, it rebooted. And it turned out that the lab that was in there before, people were used to hitting this key sequence all the time. In fact, anything happened, they would just hit this key sequence. I don't know what kind of system they were using that required you to reboot so often, but apparently it was quite widespread. So I had to solve this because we were going to allow students to log into these computers remotely. And if somebody was logged in remotely, they might get bumped off if somebody in the terminal lab sat down and rebooted the machine. So I had to find a way to turn this off. These days, you can configure this through something called the init system. But in those days, it seemed to be hard-coded. So I was a sophomore in computer science. I figured I could handle any code that got thrown at me. So I started grepping across the source code for the string Control-Alt-Delete. I found in the source code of the kernel named Linux a C function called Control-Alt-Delete. This had a couple of lines to it. Basically, all it did was a halt system call. So being a sophomore in computer science, I figured, well, if some code's not doing what you want it to, you can just comment it out, and everything will probably work just fine. So it turns out in the general case, this is a really bad idea. But in this specific case, it actually worked. I commented out the whole body of the function. I recompiled the kernel named Linux, installed it across the lab. I rebooted every computer and discovered that if I walked up to the console and pressed Control-Alt-Delete, absolutely nothing happened, which was precisely the behavior we wanted for this lab. Now, this was a rewarding and exhilarating experience. I think it's quite liberating when you give people the means to solve their own problems rather than requiring them to beg to someone else to fix their problems for them. Because of this and other experiences like it, by the mid-1990s, I really began to understand that these freedoms that free software gives a user were fundamental and very important, and that they stopped the harm that I was seeing in the proprietary software world. For everyone else, at least most people in our culture, they heard about this stuff in a very different way. They didn't experience it directly themselves. By the late 1990s, they began to hear about it in the mainstream media. And the terms got rebranded into mainstream media-friendly terms. As it turns out, though, the whole process of creating this free software began long, long before I even discovered it, and certainly long before the mass media began talking about it under different terminology. Way back in 1984, when I was busy at a Commodore 64 club being called a pirate, Richard Stallman, my boss and the founder of our foundation, was making these same observations about proprietary software that I'm putting forward today. What he discovered is that software in its natural state, which was free as in freedom, used to get the source code to the software you bought in the 1970s, by and large, was going away. And that the place where he was working at MIT was one of the last enclaves for this kind of free software. So what he did was start a movement to bring software back to this old way of doing things, where people had freedom and collaborated and worked together. And as the first act of this movement, he launched something called the GNU Project, whose goal was to create a completely free software operating system that gave you all these freedoms. But GNU was always more than just a software project and still is today. The focus was to foster this cooperation and sharing among users and programmers, to inspire people to help each other by creating free software that benefited everyone. I think it's a very interesting way to start a movement. A lot of movements, because they're so disenfranchised, have to just stand outside and protest and carry signs and write letters. We do some of that ourselves, but fortunately, the key thing that needs doing for freedom in the use of computer software can be done by almost anyone. Anyone who has a talent for programming and access to a computer can contribute to the freedom of software by writing new free software. So the GNU Project began recruiting volunteers to write free software. Richard Stallman himself wrote a lot of key components throughout the late 80s and inspired other volunteers to come on and start writing free software. And thus a movement began. Because by the mid-1980s, the world had changed. Companies had discovered that they could get huge profits by dividing the user base and conquering each individual one by one, by telling this user, you're not allowed to share with that user, and you're not allowed to share with that user, and you all must pay a licensing fee to get a copy of computer software. No, we're not going to give you the source code. No, we're not going to give you permission to share and improve the software. I believe that this process really puts people in an unfair position. When I think back to Evelyn, at that Commodore 64 club, I don't think it was fair for her to make the choice she had to make. She had to choose between obeying a software license that she had agreed to and making an altruistic act for a young child who wanted a copy of that software. I believe that laws, such as the copyright law that gets applied to software, ought to facilitate goodwill and facilitate people's natural instincts to help each other. It turns out that copyright law, as it is typically applied to software, does precisely the opposite. It puts people in a position where they have to choose between being a good neighbor and obeying the license they agreed to. Free software frees people from making that choice because you are, in fact, encouraged to share your free software. Now, some people do make out well in this proprietary software system. There's a lot of profit generated. The wealthiest human being in the world and the wealthiest corporation in the world made their money by doing this. But I believe quite strongly that profit should not be the highest motive in our society and culture. It's fine if you want to put it as number two, but I think the first motive of doing things in society should be making the world a better place, helping other people. It turns out that you can reach that second motive. You can do software in a way that is that respects freedom and makes money through the typical ways that money is made in the software industry. Most money in the software industry is made through service contracts, through custom modification on contract, through support contracts. All of these business models, which are typical in the software industry, and were even in the proprietary software world, work perfectly well with free software. And in fact, in some cases, work even a little better with free software. But there's a key problem that comes up, because you have to ensure that people are allowed to do this activity, both commercially and non-commercially, and that everyone along the distribution chain of software gets these freedoms from free software. So as the GNU project began, of course, the goal was to release the software as early and as often as possible. And once you start releasing free software, you've got to think about what the terms of distribution should be. The easiest way to make software free software is to simply put it into the public domain. That means that you assert no copyright interest on the software. You put it there out under no copyright at all into the public domain for the public good. And this does indeed generate free software. There are lots of interesting free software projects that are in the public domain. However, there's a key drawback, and we strongly believe at the Free Software Foundation that if we had done the GNU project under the public domain, it would have failed. And here's why. Because when something's in the public domain, it is free software that first time someone gets it. However, a company or anyone can take that software, assert their own copyright interest on it, make some modifications or improvements, add a few features, and then re-license that software back to the public under any terms they want, because it is now their copyrighted work. The public domain creates free software, but it doesn't defend the freedoms. So what happens is when software is under under a public domain distribution system or is under any kind of copyright license that does not go to any effort to defend freedom, you get simultaneous proprietary and free software versions of the same program. That one I was talking about at Westinghouse, XDM, the X Display Manager, was in fact available as free software. What Sun had done was taken that program, made proprietary enhancements to the software, and then relicensed it back to Westinghouse under proprietary terms. So if freedom is not defended, companies and other entities can take it away. So the GNU project needed a distribution mechanism under copyright law that would defend freedom. Richard Stallman sat down with a number of lawyers and devised the idea of copyleft. Think of copyleft as copyright turned onto its head. As I mentioned before, the The way most copyrighted software works is it comes under a license that restricts all these freedoms I've talked about. Because copyright law, when you copyright a piece of software, governs the copying, modifying, and distribution of the software, you can take all those freedoms away and say, you don't have the freedom to copy, modify, and distribute the software. What copyleft does is it turns it around and says, yes, this software is copyrighted. And under terms of copyright, we explicitly give you the permission to copy, share, modify, and redistribute this computer software. The only stipulation we put on you is that you not take away any of those freedoms from anyone else. It creates a shared software commons where you can take the software and improve it and modify it if you wish, but if you then redistribute to someone else, you have to pass along those same rights to the next person. In essence, it grants all the key freedoms, but forbids you to forbid those freedoms. Copyleft is a general idea. It needs an implementation. Like a programming idea that you have, you actually have to write it in code. The GNU General Public License, the GNU GPL, is an implementation of copyleft. It is the legal language that implements this idea of share and share alike as long as you respect each other's freedoms. Copyleft is the strategy and the GNU GPL the implementation that the GNU project under the auspices of the Free Software Foundation undertook to distribute and share free software and defend the freedoms that free software gives. Now, other strategies do exist. There is lots of other free software that is under non-copylefted terms, either in the public domain or under a more liberal copyright license. And it turns out that these communities, like the FreeBSD community, keep much of the core software free by using market pressure or threatening to make future versions incompatible with any proprietary changes as methods for keeping the software free. And this works some of the time. In fact, we at the Free Software Foundation use those same tactics to encourage freedom as well. However, the difference with the GNU GPL and other copyleft licenses is that you have a legal mechanism for defending freedom. You use the law to facilitate goodwill and encourage those who choose not to do so with some legal backing to it. And that's why we prefer GPL software, because we know we have a legal recourse to defend freedom. But as the GNU project continued throughout the late 80s and early 90s, the decision was made that we shouldn't reject software that was under non-copylefted terms. And the key rule of developing a free software operating system was find the easiest way to get free software working so that the users will have it and will switch to it. So everybody was looking for shortcuts. So in 1989, the GNU project adopted the TEC document formatting system as the official GNU formatting system. In 1990, GNU project adopted the X-Windows system as its official windowing system, which these days lives under the X386 project, or its forks, as someone was telling me earlier. And by 1991, the GNU project, under auspices of FSF, had either assembled or written from scratch all the key components of a full-fledged operating system that worked like Unix, except for one component. The component still missing in 1991 was the kernel. That's the part of the system that talks directly with the hardware, schedules jobs, manages memory, and that sort of thing. That piece of the system wasn't written yet, but people were using GNU systems all over the place with different kernels. They would get a Sun machine and install the GNU software and use it in place of the Sun Unix-like utilities that were distributed. And the GNU project began writing a kernel, but for reasons I still don't understand myself, the key rule of the GNU project was not followed in that case. Instead of picking the most straightforward and quick way to write the software, the developers picked a more experimental way to develop a kernel, one that hadn't been tried and true and put into production yet. So it took many years to even get the HERD, the GNU kernel project, working. Even today, it only barely works and you can use it if you're sort of a geek developer and know how to make systems work, but for the general users, it's not really usable. Fortunately for Freedom, at the same time Herd was getting started, another project got started to write a kernel. Linus Torvalds in Finland decided to write from scratch a free software kernel using a tried and true approach to writing kernels. By 1992, he had his kernel basically working. People downloaded it from an FTP site, this kernel called Linux, and started looking around for other free software that might work with it to make a completely usable operating system. Lo and behold, they discovered all the components to an operating system they needed. They thought they had just been fortunate to discover it all. What they actually found were the unassembled pieces of the GNU system. They combined it with Linux and released what they called a Linux system. And this term ended up being one of these media buzzwords that people hear about. But in fact, its roots don't go back just to 1991 and Linus Torvalds, but to 1984 and our work to create a free software operating system. This is why you'll hear me call these things that most people call Linux systems, GNU plus Linux systems, to point out not only the history, but the dedication to freedom that the GNU project, both through its license and through its work on software, has always focused on. I hope you'll join me in calling it GNU plus Linux or GNU Linux or GNU slash Linux, any way you want to write it or say it, so that people understand why freedom is important. The Linux project doesn't stand for the same philosophical ideas that the GNU project does. In fact, we get many emails at the Free Software Foundation saying, "I'm a Linux user. I read about your crazy free software ideas on your website, but I don't think something that crazy could ever produce a usable operating system. I'll just keep using this Linux thing instead." This is quite ironic, given that that philosophy and this dedication to the philosophical value of freedom is what generated most of the system they're using, and they don't know it. So we do this as a way to remind people about freedom. This same issue comes up with the other media term, which is open source. This term was originally invented in 1998 as a, quote, marketing term for free software, unquote, according to the founders of the Open Source Initiative. And if that were its primary goal and that's all it did, it would be great. From our point of view, we think it's great to get people to adopt free software, even if they don't necessarily agree with the politics of the free software movement. And what open source did was divorce the politics of free software, this idea that freedom is important and that users should have freedom, and that's why it's worth doing, and instead focus only on the technological benefits of the particular software. So the open source folks tend to talk about how the software is more reliable, more stable, has fewer bugs, and that sort of thing. We continue in the free software movement to talk about the issues of freedom. And it's up to you to pick which of these two movements you want to support. If you like the kinds of philosophies I'm talking about today and this idea of freedom seems important to you, then perhaps you're a supporter of the free software movement. If you're not interested in that political stuff but like the software because it's reliable and dependable, then you're probably a supporter of the open source movement. If you don't like either of these things and you want to work for Microsoft when you graduate, you're probably not a supporter of either movement. It's up to you to decide what you want to support, but understand that there's a subtle difference between these terms and that it's important to make the distinction about whether you're talking about freedom or not. And I continue to support the free software movement because I believe that computer scientists in particular must consider the ethical and sociological impact of their work. Software use has long since grown beyond just the fields of science. It's almost impossible today to get a job that doesn't require you to use some sort of software. I used to say you could wait tables and you wouldn't have to use any software whatsoever. But in fact, many times you go into a restaurant now and they have a touch screen that helps them schedule the tables that are being used at the restaurant. So it's very hard not to be involved with software in some way in your life. And I encourage people to reject the seeming convenience of proprietary software. Because the only way people get you to run proprietary software and to give up all these rights you really ought to have is promise some goodie, something that's going to be really great on your computer when you get it. Like most products that are marketed today, it turns out to often be lackluster. But they use that as a mechanism to have you give up your freedom and agree to some proprietary license. Particularly if you develop software, I want to point out that you do have a choice. There are millions of people, even today, who make money not writing software. So if you're a software developer, you don't have to write software for a living. If you choose to do so, it is possible to innovate and to make money doing free software. In fact, what happens is free software creates a competitive free market for software service and support and custom modifications and improvements. Lots of companies are doing this now. And in fact, it makes software work much like many other fields where there's a high level of expertise required work today. For example, it turns out that the law is a shared commons. You have permission, by and large, to go to a law library, most are open to the public, and study the law and learn about it, and learn all the details of the statutes and the case law that make up our legal system. You are permitted in the United States to go and defend yourself in court if you want to. You don't have to hire a lawyer. In fact, if you don't want to learn the law yourself, you can hire somebody through a law school to teach you the law and pay for that service to learn about the shared commons. But it turns out that most people, and the reason people are willing to pay to go to law school, want to hire a lawyer. When you get in trouble with the law, you don't typically go and defend yourself in court. You hire a lawyer. Why? Because that lawyer is an expert. They know more about the law than you, so you want them to help you to defend yourself in court. There is always a market for experts, despite the fact that the law is a shared commons, despite the fact that when a lawyer sits down and writes briefs for a court, which eventually get turned almost quoted verbatim into the court's opinion, which then get put into the official case law in the public domain, that lawyer still got paid to do all that work, even though it ends up in this public space that then someone else can use to write another law brief, which goes through the same process. The law is a shared commons, but people make a lot of money doing it because there's a market for experts. By and large, up until recent days, auto mechanics worked much the same way. For a very low cost, you could, at least 5 or 10 years ago, less so today because most cars include software, but before they did, you could buy the mechanics manual for very low cost. You could open up your own garage and offer services as a mechanic. When I used to own a car, I don't anymore, but when I did, I would always go to the dealer to get auto service. I knew I had to pay a lot more to get the dealer to work on the car, but you see, the dealer had free donuts every day. So I wanted a free donut when I went to get the car service, so I went to the dealer and paid extra money for it. Why? I have no clue now. But in those days, donuts were apparently really important. And I was willing to pay that. It was a competitive free market. I could have went to the garage at the end of the corner, or I could have went to the dealer or somewhere in between. And they all had the right to operate on those cars and make them better and fix them. There was a market for experts. I didn't work on my own car because I didn't know how. Lots of people, particularly in the 1970s, used to do this, used to work on their own cars and improve them and modify them themselves. They had the right to do that. Yet there were still auto mechanics during all that time. There were still the dealers who gave away donuts, who people went to get their car fixed. It's a competitive free market. What happens with free software is it creates a shared commons of software, much like the law, much like the shared knowledge about auto mechanics. And it puts everyone on equal footing. I discovered this back before I worked for the Free Software Foundation, doing free software consulting, going around installing web servers for people, making them work with Apache and get their website up and running and get them on the internet. It's what I did for most of the late 1990s to make money. Yet there were lots of big companies, IBM, for example, who were doing the same kind of work. But I was able to make a living doing it because it was free software. And IBM was using Apache, I was using Apache. And I had the ability to do a consulting business myself. What happens is that clients are not locked into solutions. I could always tell someone, hey, if you don't like my service or you think that I'm not doing a good job, you can fire me. You have all the source code to this software. You can hire anyone you'd like. It turns out that customers like it when you tell them they can fire you. Because if you're a big company, you can muscle people around. You can tell, Sun can tell Westinghouse, we're not going to fix your bug, and who else are you going to go to? After all, you have a huge installation of our machines. But a small company doesn't have that ability. They don't have the ability to say, go, you know, you can't go anywhere else for this. Because there is somewhere else to go, by and large. And also, you might be closed up in 5 years. You might not be around anymore. Your company might not exist. When you tell your customers, well, you can go to someone else. If I'm not around, you have the source code. Customers like to be able to fire you or know what's going to happen if you're gone. Now, the GPL is criticized quite heavily, particularly by companies like Microsoft, who over the past few years have called the GPL an un-American cancerous virus that ate up software like a Pac-Man, whatever that means. And they criticize it because of its requirement that derivative works of the software have to be distributed as free software when they're distributed. The problem that they have with it is based on a mistaken assumption. Their assumption is that they should benefit from the body of free software without contributing back. Microsoft has a long history of embrace, proprietorize, and extend of software. They have taken many free software components like Kerberos and TCP/IP and the standard FTP client and added proprietary modifications, and then redistributed them as part of their operating system. These free software components were all licensed under terms that were not copyleft, were not GPL, and it permitted this kind of thing. Microsoft loves it when this happens. They don't want a license that requires them to play fair with everyone else. The GPL prohibits them from benefiting without contributing back. The GPL is somewhat like a club. No one is required to join. But if you do, you have obligations to the other members. You have an obligation to uphold their freedom as you uphold your own. It keeps everyone honest. So I encourage you to avoid the kind of fear-mongering about GPL that Microsoft's most famous for but is not exclusive in. You might hear the GPL called a virus. By contrast, the GPL actually vaccinates you from harm by assuring that you won't have your freedom taken away from you. In fact, we found that the GPL specifically creates trust across international borders. People are willing to work with each other because they know the social and legal contract of GPL ensures that they won't get treated by somebody from some other country. We have free software developers working on GNU software on every continent in the world except for Antarctica. There is actually somebody running free software in Antarctica, but I've yet to find somebody writing it. Unfortunately, this trust that gets created is going to get destroyed if we don't defend it. This freedom that GPL upholds will go away if it's not actively fought for. Already today in the United States, we have on the books a law that can prohibit the distribution of GPL software. This law is called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. It was passed in 2000 with very little fanfare, late 1999, with little fanfare. No one knew about it at the time except for a few people like our organization. Today, the DMCA has already prohibited distribution of a specific GPL program called DECSS. What DECSS does is allow you to play legally purchased DVD movies on a free software system. It decodes DVDs and allows you to view them. The MPAA argued that this was an idea that people were not supposed to know, that human beings weren't intended to know how this algorithm worked. Under DMCA, it is illegal to distribute or disseminate information about any technology that can be used to circumvent so-called copy protection controls put in place on a media. The CSS encoding on DVDs, according to MPAA, was such an encoding. It was designed to stop people from copying their DVDs. However, it ultimately chipped away at fair use. It prohibited people who legally have a right to play DVDs on their computers to do so with free software. We've already lost a number of cases concerning the DECSS system. But unfortunately, this all gets worse. The FTAA, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, will extend the DMCA-like provisions all the way from the tip of Chile to the northernmost territories of Canada. We'll have both Americas being full DMCA country. In Europe, there is already the European Union Copyright Directive, which implements the DMCA, and member states are being required right now to implement it. Right now, in state legislatures around the country, they are introducing these so-called super DMCAs, which are misnamed, for they are not copyright statutes. They are technology control statutes that the MPAA is pushing to prohibit even more activities on computers, including file-sharing networks and anonymous connections over networks. We have the entire legal system being used by some of the most powerful corporations, led by Disney, to stop freedom in our culture. And why do they want to do this? Because somebody might use this technology to infringe copyright. Forget the fact that you can share the works of Shakespeare and other non-copyrighted works over file-sharing networks. Forget the fact that you can play these DVDs that you legitimately have with the free software, not making copies of them. They don't care. What they want is a leak-proof pipe from whatever media they're giving you to your eyeball and eardrum. If there's a leak anywhere in that pipe, anywhere, they can't stand it, because it means you can make a perfect digital copy of that particular content that you're viewing. So with free software, even if we wanted to plug the leaks, even if we wanted to set up free software so it didn't permit you to make copies, you always have the freedom to modify it, and somebody ultimately would read how it works in its source code and modify it. Today, we have a project called GNU Radio, published under the auspices of the Free Software Foundation under our copyright. This program can watch digital, allow you to watch digital television on your computer with some off-the-shelf components and a beefed-up PC. You can turn your computer today into a high-definition television device. Right now, the FCC is considering whether or not it wants to regulate all software by saying you can't use free software to decode a digital television signal. Why? Because the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, is pushing for a so-called broadcast flag in every digital television signal transmitted. If this broadcast flag is on, it means that you are not permitted to make a recording of that broadcast. The days of having the right to record any program you want, to watch it later, to time shift it, or to watch it on some other device, like your laptop while you're riding on a train, i.e. space shifting, are nearly gone. If we don't stop the media companies from doing this, we will not have these freedoms that we might have had. Imagine a world where your son is on television because the Little League team got coverage, and you can email that clip to grandma at her house halfway across the country. This world is coming to be, but the MPAA may stop it just because they're worried you're going to make a copy of Lilo and Stitch and distribute it illegally. They're not just using legal mechanisms either. They're using so-called industry standards and industry initiatives to quote-unquote self-regulate. There was a working group under the MPAA that was trying to set up the broadcast flag as an industry standard that all electronics manufacturers would have to produce devices that adhered to the broadcast flag. Fortunately, we at FSF, along with our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, were able to derail that effort with the help of some of the industry partners who didn't like the idea. But these efforts will come again and again. Pay attention. Act politically. If you don't take the freedom of use and redistribution and copying of software, it may go away, because those people who want to make sure that you never even think about speeding through a commercial, that you never even think about making a copy of a DVD in case yours breaks, will make it impossible for you to do anything with free software. There's lots of things, if you don't want to act politically, that you can do right here on campus. If you're working on software as part of your schoolwork or as part of your graduate thesis or as part of your employment with the university, release it as free software. I've learned today that you are apparently permitted to immediately release the software you develop under the auspices of the university as free software under your own copyright. You should check that out as best you can, but do it. Get it out there as free software if you're working on something interesting. Help the world and help people share software. Quickly, before they make a rule that says you can't, like many universities have. Finally, if you're a computer science student, think about when you graduate what you want to do. Do you want to be in a career where you're taking away people's freedoms, where you spend your life building walls to stop programmers from helping each other? Or do you want to be in a scenario where you can help the world and still make a comfortable living? You can do this under the GPL. You can do this with free software. You just have to make the choice and maybe work a little bit harder. But it can be done. Don't put profit as your first motive. Make it number two, and make your first motive helping the world. I urge all of you to fight for a free and cooperative software industry where both society and companies can profit, and users and programmers can benefit. I appreciate your time. I'm happy to take as many questions as you have. I haven't seen a hand go up yet. Go ahead.
One of the fundamental questions is how people should make a living. I touched on, well, people can do support, but this question of, well, the initial investment is quite large to develop a software product. Do you want to make that publicly available for people to modify who are willing to do so much cheaper?
Well, you know, I mean that argument often gets made, that somehow if you release the software as free software, no one will make that initial investment. And it's been proven wrong a number of times. One great example is the Samba software, which is a Unix-like services for Windows on a Unix-like operating system. You can make a Unix-like computer like GNU plus Linux be a file server for a Windows system. That software was GPL'd from the start. These days, the original authors of it are employed pretty much constantly working on it, if you can afford them. And they did it initially as an altruistic thing for a little while. But as soon as they got out of graduate school, they were employed. That's just one example among many of how people are making money doing free software and doing it from the start. Red Hat, for example, is doing lots of software development brand new from scratch. They contributed, for example, to the GNOME development because they already have a business that's supporting the software development. So it's pretty much the case that the software will get developed. Now, it turns out that on the other side, in the proprietary software world, if you want to make that initial investment, usually it ends up failing. 70% of software startups fail. The number is the same for free software startups as it is for proprietary. The difference is, with free software, your marketing is automatic. If you look at a company like MySQL AB, which now has lots of venture capital, they're a Swedish company and now have offices all over the world, they started from scratch distributing software as free software. They did it because they were interested in it. They got some consulting work continuing its development. But that was their marketing arm. Because the software was out there, up and available under GPL, people downloaded it, began to depend on it, and who do you think they called when they needed an improvement and wanted to pay for it or needed support? They called the developers, because there was a little README file on the stuff that says, you got the software under GPL, and by the way, if you need any support services or want improvements, excuse me, we're happy to take checks for it, you know, get in touch with us, that kind of thing. So if you do a proprietary software project from the ground up, you usually have to hire a big marketing arm and get them out there doing sales and convince people to part with their money just for the sake of even getting to try out your software and get it working and run it. And it turns out that's a huge expense. Whereas if you take your marketing arm as the distribution mechanism, which many companies have done successfully, you can get the product out there quickly and get people interested in it and get a user base, which then is your customer base. Let's go back around. I'll start with the guy in the back in the red plaid shirt.
Thank you. One of the advantages of using the GPL for a software startup is that you can start small.
That's right.
If you have to support that huge marketing model, you've got to have a large product. And that means you've got to have a lot of money to invest. But if you don't have to support the marketing arm, you can start small.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm going to re-say the point for the recording. The point is that if you have the desire to start small and have a few employees, you don't have to support that marketing arm if you're doing it under GPL, and you can slowly grow, which is, in fact, what most free software companies did. MySQLIB, which was my earlier example, did this. And also, it turns out that on the other side, that if you do want this big company, you can pick up an existing free software application and support it. Cygnus Solutions, which was eventually bought by Red Hat, did this for GCC, the GNU Compiler Collection. They started out with sort of medium-sized, not big, but they started out sort of medium-sized. I think they had 5 or 6 employees to start because they found all this work doing support services for existing free software. And they've grown, I think they were about 50 or 60 employees when they were acquired by Red Hat. And they are today the profitable arm of Red Hat because they had built their business slowly and started out sort of medium-sized and went to, you know, sort of a little bigger than medium-sized, and were able to employ people doing it. It's very interesting because there's another company called Code Sorcery that does the same kind of work that is still competing, even though they have 5 employees. People aren't pushed out of the space just because they're small with free software, because everybody has equal source, and there are people sitting on the GCC steering committee from Code Sorcery. There are people sitting on the GCC steering committee from Red Hat / Cygnus, and they're all able to work together and improve the common code base, which they're then going out and building commercial environments around. So you can do it on both sides. You can start small and do a GPL product from scratch, and because it's GPL, you don't need that marketing arm. And the other side is you can start medium to big by taking existing software. Yeah, this guy in the yellow shirt had his hand up before. And then I'll get back to you.
So what's the Free Software Foundation's policy or view of companies? I'm going to say something about a company now that is probably completely wrong. People yell at me later if I have no off on this. But for example, like a game company like ID Games, I guess, which will bring out something proprietary, sell it to a bunch of people proprietary, not give any of the 4 freedoms of software except for maybe using it any way they want, followed by, in the next iteration, once again giving out proprietary, but then open sourcing the previous version of their product, allowing everything at that point to be, here's all the source, you can do whatever you want with it, but now here's the newer, better version that everyone wants to buy, and so they continue that. So in a sense, they are continuing to help the community, they are getting money from their code, and you know everything's being, you know, at the end of the day, everything is nice and open sourced and software in a way, but not right away. Is there any?
Yeah, the question is about the model of releasing free software on delay. So it's initially proprietary software for some period of time and then released as free software at some point later on. The specific example of id Software was given, which does this for games. One thing I want to point out before I answer the meat of the question is that the games are substantially different in society as far as software goes for 2 reasons. One is that games are rarely just software. Games come with some software engine, along with some visual artwork, along with some audio work that's music or other types of sound effects. So these are 3 very different types of work that you conglomerate to make a game. And the licensing terms for each could be different. We at the Free Software Foundation believe that different types of work covered by copyright law should be licensed in different ways. We don't believe that there's some sledgehammer that says all things under copyright law should be licensed a particular way. We believe GPL is the right licensing scheme for software, but we don't think it's the right licensing scheme for video, for audio, for, you know, works of literature, and so forth. So it's possible that you could do a gaming structure, rather than doing it the id Software way with the delay, to license the software engine as GPL and then license the artwork and related things in a proprietary way. And it, in fact, does that in some cases. The other thing that's different about games that I want to be... I'll get to everybody. Let me finish answering this question. I have tons of time. The other thing that's different about games is that they are fundamentally different than the kinds of software I'm talking about, because they're not there for getting a job done, to be functional. I know this is strange for particularly college students to hear, but games just aren't that important. You know, they just aren't. They don't matter that much. They're just video games. They're just entertainment, which is very different from software that people need to get their jobs done. I've often said that I wouldn't bother working in the free software movement if all software in the world were free software except for video games. They just aren't important enough from my point of view. So that's the 2 points I wanted to make about games. But
why do you have a problem with the Motion Picture Association? Because that's just the movies. That's just
another thing. Look, they have their various licensing terms. The problem I'm raising, let me take that later, because let me get to other people's questions. Let me finish answering your question about the delayed release. You know, the delayed release is a compromise that we've lived with from time to time. The GNU GoScript distribution used to be a delayed released version of the Aladdin GoScript version that was put out. MySQL, in fact, for a while, the company I mentioned before, did this delayed release mechanism for their software. They made a later version GPL'd. It tends to demoralize the development community. You miss a lot of the benefits that free software gives you. Because if there's going to be a vibrant development community outside of your organization, they're going to do it around the free software version. And they're going to be less likely to do that if you make it proprietary. And the reason MySQL abandoned that mechanism was that it was very difficult for them to get contributions because people were using the GPL version. Then they were in this weird support scenario. They had to sell support for the old version because that was part of their business model. And then they were trying to license the new version. But people were saying, I just want to buy support for the version I have. I don't want to upgrade and pay you this proprietary licensing and move away from the GPL version. So it turns out not to work. And from our point of view, we're working for a world where all published software is free software. And we would want to see them do that model. We understand and we've made compromises with companies who want to experiment. We'd rather see a delayed release than never be free software. But from our point of view, it's a big compromise that we want to move ahead from. And I'll get back. Let me go through everybody's questions. I'll get back to yours. Let me get the guy in the back there. Yeah, but I think the point is clear there, that the gaming industry is ultimately different than the software you use to get a job done. I know you've got a second question back there, but I want to give first-timers a chance.
I'm
sure. Okay, a fellow in the red hair right there.
Lots of companies sort of have dual licensing schemes where they, you know, I think MySQL is one of them.
That's right.
Where they're willing to accept, you know, money to put it under another license if, for example, a company doesn't want to release their changes. Does this hurt the free software movement, and why or why not is it bad?
I'm going to restate the question for the recording. The question is, does proprietary relicensing, which is what I call it as opposed to dual licensing, just for clarification, does that hurt the free software movement? These are companies who release a product under GPL, but also offer out to the world saying, if you pay us enough money, we'll relicense it to you under another license. For those in the crowd who don't know much about licensing, I want to explain a little bit how that works. When you have sole copyright on something. You are the only copyright holder. You have the permission to release it under any license you want, and you have permission to release it again under a different license. You can release 100 copies a day under 100 different licenses to 100 different people if you'd like. So what these companies do is they hold full copyright on the work, they choose to release one version to the world under GPL, and then they say, well, if you don't want to obey the GPL, if you want to make proprietary modifications, then you can pay us to get a separate license, which we'll negotiate with you, that allows you to do that if you pay us. The key questions we ask at the Free Software Foundation when somebody's engaging in this proprietary relicensing stuff are the following. First, is the money and resources that are coming from the relicensing being siphoned back into the development of the free version? From our point of view, if they're using that revenue just to for self-perpetuating purposes, or they're using it just to build up some other part of the business that's proprietary, we would say that there's a real problem there. Because the only reason we can justify saying that's a reasonable thing to do, that's an ethical thing to do, is if they're using it as a way to get the proprietary people to fund the development of the free version. So that's the question we ask. Now, despite my inquiries, MySQL does not want to show me their balance sheets. However, from looking at the people who work at the company, I believe that the company you mentioned, MySQL AB, is in fact doing that. The second question we ask, and it's a problem that comes up that's not so easily solvable, is how do you handle the development community? One of the great things about GPL software is that others can contribute under terms of GPL with their own copyrighted work, changes that they've made, or improvements that they've done. Now, if you have this sort of scenario where people are supposed to be sharing and helping each other and improving the software, you're in a strange situation. If you want to be in the relicensing business, you've got to collect a copyright assignment. You've got to make sure you're the sole copyright holder so that you can issue that other license legally. Now, you also have to tell your contributing community, by the way, you're giving this code altruistically as an improvement, or maybe you're even one of our competitors, and we want a copyright assignment so that we can go make more money this way to do our own stuff. So that's a deterrent for people who might otherwise contribute, who say, wait, I don't want my software to be in some proprietary version. I don't want you guys to get the benefit out of the fact that I wrote the software. You're going to make the money, not me. That's not fair. So that's a real problem. The way we handle this at the Free Software Foundation, we too collect copyright assignments for free software, is we make a promise in a contract with the assignor saying we promise forever and always to release this only as free software. Now, of course, MySQL AB and other companies who do relicensing can't do that because their sole goal there is to do the relicensing. So that's a problem that comes up that's not really solvable, and that's one of the reasons we say, well, you know, it's a transitional business model at best. Try to move away from it because you're not going to be able to support the kind of sharing community that would otherwise be there. I guess I'll come back around up, so I'll do you as I think.
Directing the free software more to like operating systems and back-end systems as opposed to like desktop applications like word processors, spreadsheets, is that correct?
Well, historically, the question is we're talking primarily about operating system software, not applications. Well, you start from the ground up, right? Historically, what we had to do was write a free software operating system so that we had one. And in fact, back in those days, everybody said, well, nobody will write a free software operating system. It'll never get written because nobody wants to do it, and nobody will get paid, and you'll never do it. Forget it. You're never going to make it. And in fact, each project within the operating system project, the same argument was made. When Richard Stallman started writing the GNU C compiler, which eventually became the GNU compiler collection, everybody was saying, it's too hard to write a C compiler. No one will ever be able to write a free software one that'll be any good, that'll be widely adopted because those proprietary ones are so much better and they're always going to be there because it's so hard to do. And we proved it wrong. And in every case, it's been proven wrong. For example, everybody said, well, you guys got an operating system, but there's never going to be an Office suite. And then a company decided to release OpenOffice as free software, and now it's maintained as part of a free software infrastructure in the community. So it's the case that we did operating system software first because it was the first job that needed to be done. But that level of what's being commoditized and what's becoming free software keeps getting higher and higher. You know, there was a time when people said there won't be a really reliable free software SQL database. Well, MySQL is pretty reliable now, and it's getting better all the time. And it's GPL'd. So it's our opinion that eventually we can work to a world where all published software is free software. but it will take time. But after all, we're the foundation. We think long term. Yeah, let me get you back there.
What about the LGPL, which, from my understanding, allows people to make proprietary software that has GPL software at the core of it in a way?
The question's about the lesser general public license, the LGPL or lesser GPL. That is a halfway point in between full copyleft and no copyleft. So it allows certain types of proprietary derivative works, proprietary enhancements to free software, but prohibits others. The reason we designed the lesser GPL was to find a way to uphold freedom best in certain cases. The specific case that we were dealing with when we designed the lesser GPL, and the case where we think it applies today, is when there is already an existing set of software in library format that does the job you're trying to do. So when the GNU C library started to get written, it was going to be released under GPL. At the time, there were hundreds of proprietary C libraries available under all kinds of different licensing from all different kinds of companies. And the question was, well, what happens if we release the GNU C library under GPL? Well, that means that any work that links against the C library becomes a derivative work, the whole work of the combination of your work and the C library as a unit has to be GPL'd. So that means anytime somebody compiles a program on a GNU system, and today the GNU plus Linux system, it would have to be free software. So the only people who could develop for this system would be free software developers. And our thought was, well, we would like that to be the case. We wish the world was all free software, but it's not. And there's going to be proprietary software, at least in the short and medium term. So what do? We'd better do something different, because somebody will realize this, make a C library that runs on the GNU system that is proprietary, and start selling licenses to it. So anybody who's running proprietary software on a GNU Linux system would have a C library that was also proprietary. That's not really good for freedom. We want to give users as much freedom as we can think of in some way. So the lesser GPL is designed to say, okay, if you write an application that just makes calls to the API of the library, you can make your application proprietary. However, you have to keep the library component free software. And if you make direct improvements, changes to the source files of the library, those have to be free software. So the idea was, okay, people are going to write proprietary applications for GNU plus Linux systems. We've got to live with that. But let's license the C library in a way that at least gives people the freedom to upgrade their C library, to modify their C library, to improve it, right from underneath a proprietary application. And let's also put some requirements on the proprietary application that we want to see if there's going to be proprietary software. For example, a proprietary license for a software program that combines with an LGPL program can't prohibit things like reverse engineering. So you have to be able to be allowed to reverse engineer for debugging purposes the proprietary components so that you can upgrade and change your C library from underneath it. So it's not, you know, it's a way to defend freedom in this special case. And if you're in a case where you're writing a software program that's just like 100 other libraries that are already out there proprietary, the lesser GPL is probably a good choice. But if it's a new and innovative thing, the GPL, from our point of view, is a better choice because it ensures that if people want to make use of your thing, they have to do it in a free software way, or they have to do without that special new thing that you've created. All right, I'm going to keep going with first timers. I'll go over here. Or actually, back there. You asked before I thought. You know, there's an interesting thing happening in the embedded world right now. The point that the questioner was making is that in the embedded world, there's traditionally much more proprietary than the commodity hardware world, and how will free software get inroads there? Well, it turns out that what's actually happening, particularly in the Japanese manufacturers of embedded products, is that for years they have been infringing each other's copyrights left and right. They have been trading code, among their engineers all the time. There's tons of violations of each other's licenses all over the place. And they, as far as we can tell, are terrified that this is going to become widespread in public, that Sharp is going to discover that Mashusta has their code and there's going to be some big battle. they're flocking to free software because it's a way for them to come clean about all this. They can say, okay, we're doing free software. We know how to develop a proprietary application for free software. So we're going to put free software in the device. After all, the licensing of operating systems for embedded devices is getting really silly. Devices are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and they've basically gotten the per unit cost of proprietary operating system license for small devices down to a dollar or so per unit. But when the devices are 50 cents, should you pay twice for the software? The embedded manufacturers are starting to think this doesn't make sense. They want commodity software alongside that commodity hardware, and then charge extra for proprietary applications that they'll likely develop, unfortunately, from our point of view. But it's very interesting because they're flocking to free software because they want out of this proprietary licensing and worried about the cloak and dagger of whose code they actually have in their proprietary device. This is actually good news in another front because a lot of these devices are going to be playing MPAA movies, are going to be playing RIAA music. You know, left to their own devices, the MPAA and the RIAA would destroy free software. Left to their own devices, we would be screwed. Fortunately, they're not left to their own devices. We have their devices. So I think that what's going to happen in the embedded world is there's going to be more free software, not less, for the reasons I've stated. Yeah, in some cases that's true, but by and large, it turns out that it's cheaper to do it in software and burn it onto the ROM than it is burn it onto an electronically programmable ROM than it is to actually burn it into the hardware. Is there any new questioners, people who haven't asked yet that want to ask? Well, you've already asked. Let me get you in the anti or the DECSS T-shirt.
Yeah. Front's not illegal, back.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the question is, you know, given that you know there's a lot of chipping away of freedoms happening through DMCA and other legal and industry mechanisms, how do you get people to think about these issues? It is a hard problem, a very hard problem. We've launched something called the Digital Speech Project to help build a coalition and organize people who aren't just programmers about this issue. We've reached a lot of programmers. A lot of programmers are very angry and upset and wearing T-shirts like yours. However, outside the programming world, there is not much awareness of what's going on. And we're looking very closely at ways to do this. One of the ways that I think is going to be really helpful in the future is that the MPAA has chosen to attack free software via digital television. They've picked that as the venue where they're going after free software right now because they want the broadcast flag as digital television gets rolled out throughout this decade to be there so that people can't record perfect digital copies of movies and share them on the internet. That's what they're trying to stop, and they're going to kill free software for the sake of that. And they're also going to kill a lot of things people are used to. People right now with their VCRs are used to being able to tape anything they can watch. And that's not going to be the case with digital television. The MPAA is going to try to make some sort of case that you're getting such better technology that it's worth it to give up these things you used to have. And that TiVo that used to work, well, that's not going to work anymore. But that's okay because it's digital. It's digital television now. And I think that it's going to be a great venue for us, too. If there is anything people in the United States care about a lot, it's television. So when you tell people, your television is not going to do what it used to be able to do, it's your TV, man, in 10 years, or in 5 years, or in 3 years, whenever it's going to happen. That's one way to get people excited about it. Another way that we're working on is we're trying to develop materials to help explain the issues. You know, when I try to explain the broadcast flag to people, it takes 15 minutes to get to the point where I can tell them, and this is what it's going to mean for you, because it's such a complex issue. And in fact, they're burying it in technical details and obscure committees and any way they can to make the general public not know about it. So we're trying to develop materials, and we're hoping to get a funding grant to do this, to organize groups like independent filmmakers and musicians. Independent filmmakers and independent musicians are going to be screwed. You won't be allowed to buy the technology that allows you to burn your own CDs pretty soon. It's going to be prohibitively expensive. Right now, to do a movie quality DVD, the DVD burner you have to drive or have to buy to be able to do it is about $2,500 to $5,000. So already, if you're an independent filmmaker, you're going to have this huge cost just to get a device that can burn a DVD fresh from the start high enough quality to distribute. So we have to organize these groups that are going to be impacted and explain to them how they're going to be impacted and get them mobilized. It's hard work, and a college campus is a great place to do it. So I hope you'll do it here. And we're going to be providing as much resources as we can with the limited budgets we have to help provide materials. I do want to hit people who haven't asked before, if it's quick. Right. Mm-hmm. That's right, and that's a lot of the arguments we've been making. Is there a question there that you have specifically? Right. Yeah, I mean, there's, and of course, you know, in the DECSS case, we and EFF were making very strong free speech arguments about the issue. But we found that raising it as a free speech issue with the general public tends not to work. It works with programmers, explaining that programming is speech and we ought to have a right to do it, and it's beginning to work in courts a little bit, and we hope to have it work in courts more, that programming is speech and you should have a right to tell people how things work, and it should be protected speech. But I don't know if that's going to get the average person in the United States excited about the issue. If you find a way to do it, let us know, because we'll use it, certainly. We're not afraid of good ideas, but we have not seen it working, unfortunately. A lot of people in the United States don't want to hear about free speech arguments. I know you guys are waiting. I want to get to all the first timers first. Yeah, go ahead. Well, let me get the great guy in the granny first.
On the topic of Palladium or whatever it's called now, what's the FSF doing to go against it? Because last I heard, Microsoft had both Intel and AMD either arm behind the back or something to get them to do it.
Well, we have a lot of ideas about how to attack all the so-called trusted computing initiatives. Trusted computing initiatives are a misnamed idea of what your computer will be in the future. Your computer will trust external entities, not you. What Palladium and other trusted computing initiatives will do is say, okay, if you don't have a certain chip installed on your hard drive, in your computer that's non-modifiable and has all kinds of different schemes to stop you from modifying it, and if that chip does not report that the operating system you're running is a so-called trusted operating system, read, that the MPAA does not trust your operating system, you can't view this movie, you can't go to this website, you can't do lots of different things. So it's a real threat to freedom, because it means that you can't run your own software on your own computer if you want to be allowed to view anything in the world that they've decided to protect in that kind of way. We have a couple of things we want to do. We would like to get together a good list of hardware that is clearly free as in freedom and encourage people to buy it, and keep a good, clear list of what things have trusted computing stuff in them when they're shipped, and encourage people to avoid those and write letters and so forth. We don't have the resources to launch that kind of campaign. We wanted to do it for a year, and we don't have the resources, unfortunately. And we also want to make people aware of what will happen if free software operating systems decide to go to trusted computing. It is currently possible to have a free software operating system that is quote-unquote trusted by the MPAA, because you can distribute separately signed information about the binaries, so your freedom to modify isn't there. Because if you modify it, well, it's not a trusted device anymore, and then you can't view anything anymore. So we're working in GPL version 3 to try to address this issue from a licensing perspective, to make sure that free software will remain free and not end up in this so-called trusted computing space. And that's work that we're trying very hard to do, but it's not easy. And hopefully we'll be successful. Yeah, let me get Lewis, you had a question? Mm-hmm. And then I'll get this guy over here. I see you two in the back. I know, I want to get first timers first. We're against the whole idea of non-disclosure agreements for generally useful technical information. Basically, that's in some sense what a proprietary license is. It is a non-disclosure agreement for anything that's technically useful. And we think that if hardware requires that kind of NDA just to get it working, the people ought to avoid that hardware. And this is, in fact, one of the things we want to do with the hardware list, as well as addressing the so-called trusted computing issue, is encourage people to only buy hardware where people have made this, where the companies have made the specifications freely available so that free software drivers can be written and do exist. And I would encourage any developer, don't sign an NDA. You're all right that it will limit your possibilities of working somewhere else. And not only that, but you're making a promise not to help other people, not to tell people how a particular piece of technology works. So it's the issue of free software drivers for hardware is really important. Lots of hardware is out there that will work with your free software system if you install some little piece of proprietary software. We encourage people to avoid that hardware and find equivalent hardware that has free software drivers for it. So I'm going to get this guy in the black shirt over here. We're having some. A lot of law professors are very serious about what we're doing. I mean, we're doing some of the most innovative work, at least according to lawyers I talk to, in copyright law that's being done today. I mean, copyright law is a pretty boring topic unless you talk about, we're using copyright law to encourage people to share, and that's something innovative. So lawyers are interested in that aspect. We have two pro bono lawyers who work with us who, of course, are very interested. One of them is a pretty famous law professor named Eben Moglen at Columbia Law School. And there's also Larry Lessig at Stanford Law School, who's written a number of books on this issue of what copyright should do in the digital age. I encourage you to pick them up and read them if you get a chance. The first one's called Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. The second one's called The Future of Ideas by Larry Lessig, L-E-S-S-I-G. And he's very interested in these issues. Getting regular, everyday working Joe lawyers, it's been difficult. They're hitting it because lots and lots of companies are using free software, and lots of the patent and copyright counselors are getting the GPL thrown on their desk. So we're getting interest in that way, and we've had a lot of people come around and be interested. But it's a difficult thing. We're changing the world of how the world works, and it takes a while for people to get adopted. And the programmer saw it first, as it turns out. Is there anybody? You haven't asked yet in the jeans jacket. Oh yes, in fact, in our digital speech project, we have a committee that runs the project. It includes someone from the American Library Association, includes filmmakers, musicians, artists, people who will be affected by changes in the way technology is allowed to be used. Yes, librarians are under great threat because just providing information is becoming illegal in the United States. Because So let me get back to, is anybody else not asked a question yet that wants to ask one? Okay, well, let me get back to you in the final, and then you and standing in the back, and then you over here. I can't take credit for that. That is, in fact, Larry Lessig's analogy that I reuse. So I should give credit where credit is due.
Well, Larry Lessig is genius.
I'm unfortunately not really following. What's the point here? I'm not sure where you're going. From our point of view, we want to look at copyright law under the terms of its original constitutional intent in the United States. Copyright law was invented not for the people who generated these creative works, but rather for the public. It was designed to make sure that the public would get access to new ideas and new creations and new things that came into being of intellectual endeavor. What the Constitution says is Congress has permission to create copyright law, not a mandate, but permission to create copyright and patent law if it is deemed useful for the advancement of science and the useful arts, as to use the phrase from the Constitution. Copyright law was created with that goal, to promote progress. And from our point of view, the question we ought to be asking is, does this particular implementation and use of copyright law promote progress? It is our position that in the software space, the best way to promote progress is to do it in a shared commons that's under GPL in a way that makes sure that nobody can cheat anybody else by taking their freedoms away. But we would like to see a world where we're having the kind of debate you're talking about, where we're debating whether or not this is good for society, good for people, good for the public. It's not that somebody has a deity-given right to hold copyright on something. It's a legal mechanism we invented to make sure that people would create, to give them that incentive to create, as some people have put it. From our point of view, that's not as important as what the public benefit comes out of it. Copyright law was invented in the age of the printing press, when it was very, very difficult to build a printing press and you had to invest lots of money and so forth and to actually get to the point where you could make copies of books. We're in a society where everyone has a printing press on their desk, at least in the industrialized world. I have one sitting right next to me. Any digital computer can make seamless copies for the cost of a little bit of electricity of as many works of art, literature, music, software as you'd like. And what we're encouraging is people to reconsider copyright law in terms of what is the best way to benefit the public and the public's right to get access to works in the digital age. And yes, we'll figure out how to make it all work, but we're not even having the debate. And there is a spectrum there. I would say the spectrum is primarily about different types of works. You know, how should we license software versus music versus movies? They all need different licensing systems from our point of view, so that we get the benefit to the public in the right way. I want to make sure I move on and catch. Let me catch everybody's question and give everybody a chance here. That's right. I don't know if legislating it is the best tact to go for. It is much better to start looking at ways to provide the governments with the kind of software they need based on free software technology. It is true that you have to make sure that there's not a non-competitive thing. For example, most governments across the United States in the states are acquiring their operating systems on non-competitive terms, which really shouldn't be happening. People should have a right to competitively bid for contracts with the government, and a lot of times they're just being handed to proprietary software companies, for example, Microsoft. So encouraging a more competitive process, I think, would help free software, and encouraging people to do government work with free software is probably a better tack than getting legislation passed. From my point of view, and this is not necessarily foundation policy, these laws are probably a fad. It's interesting right now that people want to pass laws. It's having success outside the United States. But in the United States, I don't think we're going to see it. I mean, at the same time, some of these laws are being introduced, for example, in California and Oregon, you mentioned. In Oregon, we have another law that will make certain types of free software illegal. So I don't think the state legislatures is the place we need to have this battle. I think the place to have this battle is in the administrative branch, convincing the CTOs and CIOs of various states, administrative branches that, hey, you ought to be doing some free software. And I think that, if you want to do the work in New Jersey, is try to get meetings and get in touch with people who are high up, high ranking in the administrative aspect of putting these bids out and deciding what kind of technology they acquire. I think that's probably a better approach than trying to get the legislators to pass something. Yeah, but to legislate that is really hard. I mean, really, as I said, I think it's the administrative branch you need to be talking to, because they're ultimately, even if you get a law passed, right, they're going to be the ones who have to implement that law, and then you're back at the same problem. You've got to convince them to pay attention and do it the right way. Why not go right to the source? Why not raise the awareness with the people writing these RFPs? What's that? I couldn't hear that. I'm sorry. Anyway, I'll get over to here. They seem to be spawning off conversation.
Are you concerned with how to enforce your GPL? whether you can determine whether someone has used the code and whether you can afford to, you know, test them out in court and go against Microsoft.
Well, you know, we've been doing GPL enforcement for about 10 years. We of course believe the GPL needs to be enforced, because if you have this sharing community where people are helping each other and there's rules about share and share alike, somebody has to try to make sure that when their code is being used under GPL, that people are doing it under terms of GPL that is share and share alike. So we have been doing GPL enforcement on our own copyrights, that software that we publish copyright by FSF, for about 10 years. Now, going to court is a different matter. We strongly believe that going to court is not the best way to do GPL enforcement. Because after all, usually people go to court to sue over some large amount of money. And what we want is not a large amount of money. We want people to comply with the terms of the license and respect the community. And we've been doing GPL enforcement by saying that for a decade. We tell people, look, we've discovered that you violated the GPL. We discover them primarily and almost exclusively by emails from the public, usually some company that's purchased a product and says, gee, this really looks like Bash inside this thing that I have. This really looks like GCC. I wonder if it is. And they send it to us and say, I think it is. And we confirm it, and we do the enforcement. We tell people, hey, all you've got to do is comply with the license. For the stuff that you modified, you have to give the source code along with the binaries that you distribute. You can continue charging whatever price you want as long as you're giving people the source code. You have the freedom to do that, but you've got to respect the freedom of the people you're redistributing to. And we have, in every case to date, gotten companies who have violated the GPL to comply without ever filing a court case. A few times we've had to threaten it. A few times we've said, it's been a year since we told you about this GPL violation. We've been trying to get you into compliance, and you haven't been listening. We're probably going to have to sue you. In both those cases where it got that far, we got a phone call within 2 weeks from a new counsel at their company saying the old counsel didn't know what he was doing, and absolutely they wanted to comply with the GPL. What we believe is happening is they're taking a real look at the license. And what their counsel are saying is, you can comply with this license today, and after all, they're not asking for huge sums of money. They just want you to do the right thing. Or you can comply with this license later after they sue you and win, because the license looks pretty enforceable to me. So it's not the case that we have to get into court to somehow build the license up as an enforceable thing. It's clearly enforceable because we've been doing it. The other part of your question about how you find out, well, that's a different problem. We haven't faced that problem yet, primarily because we have so few resources to do GPL enforcement, we can barely keep up with the GPL violations we find just by people emailing them to us when they discover them. We have not had the resources to go and research because we don't have the resources to do more enforcement. This is something we're very concerned about, and we have told the community that we cannot continue doing enforcement off the backs of our individual donors forever. After all, what's happening right now is individual donors of the Free Software Foundation are subsidizing corporate GPL violations with their donor dollars because we're having to clear them up with that money. So we're going to have to find a way to solve that, and we're telling the people who play nice, hey, look, IBM, you know, you get a lot of benefit out of GPL software. You comply with the license. When you have a problem, you fix it really fast when we call you. However, if you don't make sure that we continue to enforce the license, your next competitor will be able to violate the GPL and nobody will stop them. While you're there playing nice, they're going to undercut you. So they haven't been listening yet, but we hope they will. I'll get you, I guess, because I don't think there's anybody else. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, which means our books are open. You can go to GuideStar.com and read about our most recent $305,000 loss last year, if you're interested. I've fortunately turned that around so that we're actually going to break even this year. But yes, our books are open because they have to be legally, and you can find that information on the web. We are a nonprofit because we believe that is the right way to structure an organization that's trying to promote freedom. We have a charter that clearly says we exist to promote freedom in the use of software. We have contractual obligations out to our copyright assignors that say we are required to continue to release this free software. And that's how we believe the right model for organizing an organization that's going to defend and advocate the freedom of the use of software. I mean, that's the best I can answer the question.
Why aren't you making that anywhere in here, though?
It should be in there somewhere. I mean, maybe there's not something specifically in the literature there. I apologize. The particular literature that I brought today doesn't say we're a 501c3 nonprofit. I apologize. But it's on our website, and it's all over the place, so it's pretty easy to find. So, oh, okay. There's another brochure that I don't have that usually has it, which is not with me today. I apologize. Yeah, in the green shirt there. You know, it turns out to be the case that every security expert in the world, except those on the bankroll of Microsoft, have said that having full access equally to everyone of the source code of software is the best way to keep it secure. This has been backed up by things like BugTrack, which is a full disclosure mailing list about bugs in software that allow security breaches. It turns out that if a free software program has a security problem in it, it gets posted to BugTrack, just like if it's a proprietary software program. The average time, I don't know what the average time is because I don't have the exact numbers, but it's usually the case that within a few hours, someone has a patch to the free software program that will close the security bug. Because there's lots of people following that list who are security professionals and want to fix the software and make it secure. So they post a patch, it gets rolled in within hours usually into the canonical free software distributions like Debian, GNU plus Linux, and gets out there to people. Whereas with proprietary software, it takes weeks to even get them to pay attention to the bug. So it turns out that if you have lots and lots of people auditing the source code and paying attention to what's going on with it, you can fix security bugs much more quickly. And it's widely believed in the security community that so-called security through obscurity, hiding the source code of the software to make it more secure, is not really, because you can decompile stuff, you can analyze network traffic, you can do all sorts of ancillary things without the source to find security problems, and the people who are going to spend the time doing that are the people who want to break in. Whereas auditing the source code is easy and lots of people do it. If you're interested in a particularly secure free software operating system, you can go with the Department of Defense of the United States and use OpenBSD. I'm not that obsessed with security, so I use GNU plus Linux. But that is considered by the Department of Defense the most secure operating system. A recent report done by Terry Bollinger at MITRE claimed, and I saw his presentation where he claimed this, that we would have severe national security problems if the Department of Defense stopped using free software. So the Department of Defense thinks it's secure. I presume that's a pretty good authority. At least MITRE does. Anybody else? Okay, we're going out to dinner if anybody wants to join us. It's at a place called Zafra. It's on 46 Patterson Street. Anybody's welcome to attend. If we get too many people, we may have tabling issues, I presume, but anybody who wants to come may and ask more questions. I have this rule I created, though, because invariably I get some sort of sandbagger who wants to ask me the really, really nasty question right when I'm about to start eating. So the rule is if you have really unfriendly questions, you have to ask them now, not at dinner. So I reopen the floor for questions for any remaining unfriendly questions, which I am absolutely happy to take, just not over a meal. Okay. There's usually somebody who asks an unfriendly question. Not today. Okay. Okay, go ahead. Well, I think that the reconciliation issue is a difficult one. We spend a lot of time at the Free Software Foundation doing a lot of diplomacy to get free software communities working together and talking, and we hope that we can resolve the concerns that a few people on Debian Legal have right now concerning this issue. Now, the concerns about the free software documentation license, free documentation license, rather, you know, are from our point of view, not looking at the whole picture. We believe that different types of work should be licensed differently and should have different mechanisms for licensing so that you can get certain things done. We think that it is reasonable to have in a technical document non-technical material that's passed along with it that explains the history of the work or how it came to be and that sort of thing. For example, we have always licensed our website under verbatim copying permissions. This speech today is copyrighted by the Free Software Foundation and licensed to you under terms to copy verbatim in any medium that you see fit. I'm not giving you permission to modify this speech because it's a speech about political and philosophical views, not something that's generally useful technical information. But if I'm giving you generally useful technical information, I want you to have the right to modify and share in the, share and modify in the same way and share your modified versions. So you have this case in a lot of technical books where you have some parts that are the generally useful technical information and then some parts that are philosophical or otherwise tell the history of how the work came to be or talk about the company that produced the work. And we believe that you should be able to put these together in the same whole unit and work with that. So that's the way that we chose to implement it. Writing a documentation license is hard. We've done a pretty good job at doing one. We don't claim that it's the perfect way to license documents, and there will be future versions in years to come. But we feel that it is important to be able to aggregate those two different things together and put them into one whole unit. Well, there's also fair use. We strongly believe in the idea of fair use, right? So you can take short sections of the work and reuse it, and that's not copyrighted. It's only when you copyright large sections. And I certainly encourage you to use the ideas you've heard today. After all, things are copyrightable when they are ideas expressed in a tangible medium. The things that are in your brain are not copyrightable because you can reproduce them. You could, in fact, give a speech that sounded very much like mine based on the ideas you heard, and it would be solely your copyrighted work anyway. This is all kinds of things you're allowed to do under fair use. Copyright law has limits, and we're glad that it has limits. The MPAA, on the other hand, doesn't want it to have any limits whatsoever. They want it to last forever. They keep buying perpetual copyright on the installment plan every time Steamboat Willie's copyright is about to expire. But we believe that you ought to have fair use, and all the unregulated uses ought to continue. So feel free to use fair use, unregulated use of the speech, and do it with what you will. Count what, huh? Leaving? Going to. Well, we'll break and then we can do that. That's probably the best way to go. Is there any more questions? Okay. Well, why don't we just bring everybody who wants to go to dinner, like, up to the stage or something? So Lewis is going to put a stake in the ground somewhere that says where you go if you're coming to dinner. Put your stake. Virtual steak. Of course, you won't have any steak because it's a vegetarian restaurant.